You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, neato, nifty knowledge nerds. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 237. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your orating orchestra of original organisms orbiting ortolans.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Chris.
Oh,
let me take
ortolan.
The towel off of my head real quick. Ah, delicious.
Going way back with the ortolan.
I think it was made popular recently because of some pop culture show. I think it's Succession.
I came across something fun that made me laugh and smile that I want to share with you two. You know, part of being parents of young children is you absorb a lot of children's programming. The kids show Bluey. Many families I know love it around the world. The Australian show Bluey, about the little cartoon dog and her family and her little sister. And so Bluey, the dog on the show, is based on a real dog breed, an Australian cattle dog. And they kind of come with like a really distinctive blue, you know, sheen to their coat. And I looked at the pictures. I'm like, oh, yeah, that dog does look kind of blue. But then I learned that Bluey is also the name of the Guinness World Record verified, authenticated, longest living dog. Okay.
Whoa.
There was a dog who died in 1939, it was a long time ago, named Bluey. And Bluey was an Australian cattle dog. You know, there are people who say they had dogs who lived longer.
Yeah.
But this again is Bluey is verified with birth records and death records as the top spot as longest living dog verified by
how
age. Well, do you guys want to guess? What do you think? What do you guys think? I didn't mean to turn it into a quiz here, but hey, that's the spirit of our show.
31.
Wow, no way.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. It's got to be older than like 18 or 20.
Older than 18 or 20. Karen, 18 years wouldn't even get you to number 20 on the list of longest. Yeah.
Jeez.
Bluey was 29 years, 160 days years old when she passed.
Wow.
Really incredible. Born in 1910, passed in 1939. So then, of course, I ended up looking at the list of longest living dogs verified by age. Now, what made me laugh is, I mean, look, this is a celebration of these dogs' lives. I am not in any way laughing that they are dead. I'm just going to read down the name for you guys. This is, you know, just to come across these official list. So here's the list of longest living dogs by age. Bluey, of course. Bluey.
Yes.
Butch, Snooky, Taffy, Adjutant, Booksy, Pooske, Bramble, Sugar, Piccolo, Merzin, Pebbles, Kira King, that's Kira King, one word.
Uh-huh.
Toby Keith, that's Toby Keith, one word. Chanel, Abby, Sugar Ray, Otto, Seamus, Sodorakis, Megabyte, Winston Ra, Lady, and Willie.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like the worst season of Jersey Shore ever.
Yeah. The Willie there at number 24 lived 20 years, 106 days.
Wow.
A little Jack Russell Terrier from the UK. So let's... Hats off to all of these dogs.
I tip my hat to you, dogs.
Good job, dogs.
Good job, dogs.
Well, without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Here, I have a random trivial pursuit card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers. Let's answer some questions. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. Quote, out of the mountain of despair, a stone of hope is etched into the Washington, D.C. statue of which leader?
Out of a mountain
of
despair.
Out
of
the mountain of despair, a stone of hope is etched in the Washington, D.C. statue of which leader?
Colin first.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Correct.
Okay.
Good job. Pink Wedge, which tune was so requested that Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant said, I'd break out in hives if I had to sing that song in every show. Chris.
Is it Stairway to Heaven?
Denied. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay, all right, okay, okay.
Correct. Next question, Yellow Edge. Which decade of the 20th century was nicknamed Roaring? Chris.
The Roaring 20s.
Purple Wedge. Which diarist's image is on the California State Quarter along with the scene of Yosemite, the park he helped conserve?
Oh.
Colin, Mr. Hike?
John Muir?
Yes, correct.
Oh, okay. Wouldn't call him a... Okay.
A diarist?
A diarist, yeah.
It seems like he was more than that.
He was more than that, but yeah, right, strictly speaking, it's true. Yeah, yeah.
I have Twitter. I'm a diarist. All right. In 2013, doctors completed the first full transplant in the U.S. of what body part?
In what year?
2013.
The first full transplant in the U.S. of what body...
That assumes maybe it was done somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Colin.
2013. Hand.
Oh, incorrect. I like
that. Okay, it's not hand. 2013. It's got to be something more difficult. It's not head. Gee, what could they transplant that would be really difficult? Belly button.
That would be very difficult. That would be right. Hard. Incorrect, incorrect. Colin, what's your next guess?
Is it, I censored myself on the first one. Is it face?
It's face.
Oh, face.
Yeah.
Face.
Yes. Yep. I do remember that.
All right. Last question. Orange Wedge. In 2012, which U.S. holiday surprisingly surpassed Cinco de Mayo and Super Bowl Sunday to become the day most avocados are eaten?
Okay.
I'm sorry. Read what? That again. Okay.
From the beginning.
In 2012, which U.S. holiday surprisingly surpassed Cinco de Mayo and Super Bowl Sunday to become the day most avocados are eaten? Chris.
Independence Day.
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay, all right, July. All right.
You know, really, in the form of guacamole. Like this. It seems like that's where it's going.
Let's be honest here. Yeah.
All right. This week. Actually, first I want to ask you guys, have you guys ever been to a brunch or a breakfasty place where they offer bottomless mimosas?
Oh, I not only have I been, sometimes I'll seek them out. Oh, yeah.
I've only done it once.
It's definitely like an eyes bigger than the stomach kind of scenario. Yeah.
Yes.
By the time you've had enough like alcohol in the champagne that they're giving you in these mimosas, you've also drunk like a ton of orange juice. You know, you're not really thinking like, it's like, do you want to drink 5 glasses of orange juice? It's like, no, I don't. It's like, well, what if I cut it with like 25% champagne? It's like, oh, then yeah, okay, I guess I will. And then you feel like garbage. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. After like three, after three, it becomes a test of your commitment more than anything else. Yeah.
Right.
I did it once. I once went to a brunch place in the city. 4 hours later, I found myself at my gym, standing under a shower, fully clothed. And it turns out I puked all over myself. I was responsible enough to be like, I better clean myself up. Where can I go? I'm going to go to the gym and I'm going to like shower.
There's a kernel of a good idea in there. Yeah.
And so telling that story to someone inspired me. Oh, let's talk about morning stuff.
Oh, okay.
Morning routines. We talked about OJ just now, taking showers, waking up. And so this week, it's a good morning brain.
It's morning, everybody. Are either of you guys morning people? Would you call yourself a morning person, Colin?
I would not. Categorically, I would say I'm not a morning person.
But I want to be a morning person so bad. And I think just having kids kind of forces you to be a morning-ish or functional during the morning.
Yeah, you don't really have a choice. Yeah, with the kids. Like you have to get up now. Yeah, it used to be the don't talk to me in the morning until I've had my coffee, you know, person, like, until I got off of coffee and now he can talk to me. It's okay. I'm just not like a fan of getting, it's like, I need the alarm clock to be able to get up. I probably need to set the alarm clock a little earlier than it, you know, but it, either way, before they had alarm clocks, they of course had a rooster. Yeah. They had barnyard buzzers. Exactly.
Yeah.
Can you believe that when I got the idea for what I wanted to talk about, I thought for a second, oh, I'm going to have to download a clip of a rooster crowing for the second. They make that noise. They crow in the morning, right? Okay, so here's a question. Why do they do that? Why do they do that from a physiological standpoint? Like, what triggers a rooster to crow in the morning? Does anybody want to, like, throw something out there?
I mean, the classic, you know, trope is that it's the light, you know, that it's the sunlight. That's I think what the, now, whether that's true or not, Chris will advise us.
Is it mating?
Temperature, maybe?
You know what? We're going to get to all of this.
Okay.
Okay, so actually, let me ask you guys this. Here, let me ask another question. Let me throw this out there. Close your eyes and picture a typical scene with a rooster on, you know, he's on the farm. And he's doing his big first crow of the morning. He's crowing loudly as the sun comes up and he's crowing so everybody around can hear him, okay? So in this mental image that you have, where is the rooster standing?
In my head, he's on a fence post.
He's on a fence post? Oh, yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought you were going to say. So yes, roosters will crow from the fence. I mean, that's the typical picture, right? They will get up onto a high vantage point like the fence when they crow so that everybody will hear them. and also because it sort of goes along with them surveying their territory, right? Because the roosters and the flock, you know, they're very territorial, you know, so they might crow simply as a way of announcing their territory to other roosters that might be around, predators that might be around, anybody that might be around. So if a rooster hears a loud noise, like if a car drives by the farm or something like that, the rooster might crow back to be like, hey, giant predator, whatever you are, these are my chickens, you know, whatever your deal is, you need to back off. So the crowing in that sense is sort of like this, hey, everybody, like, this is my territory. If you can hear me, get out, you know? I actually did get attacked by a rooster once. True story. I was at summer camp, probably 10, 11 years old. And there was a little, like, little animal farm, like on the summer camp, like a little fenced off area where they had like a couple of pigs, you know, roosters, some chickens laying eggs, stuff like that for, like, you know, nature learning type stuff. Right. So, you know, one day they like took us all down there in a group and opened up the fence and everybody sort of walked into the farm and walked around with the animals and stuff like that. Fine. We all left. And then the next day we had like free time and I like went back to that fenced off area. I went in to hang out with the animals again. And I walked in just by myself and the rooster of this farm came up and just started pecking the crap out of me. just started going in
Where?
on my legs. He just started pecking at my calves, basically, and I ran out of the farm with the rooster in hot pursuit, pecking me out the gate, basically.
Oh, my God.
I had little bruises all up and down the backs of my legs.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is when the rooster is crowing, their mouth is writing checks that their beaks are about to cash, basically. Like, they will, but the rooster was correct in the sense that he immediately perceived a danger to his flock,
yes,
which is
yes,
unknown, you know, predator coming in, don't know who you are, don't know if you're dangerous or not, and just pecked me right on out of there.
Yep. And you helped kind of reinforce his behavior because he's like, well, that worked, so I'll do that next time.
Yeah.
If you put two roosters together who don't know each other, they will just start fighting for dominance. They will fight to establish the pecking order, right?
Right.
And the pecking order is literally like a linear order. When you have groups of chickens, hens, roosters, you know, they all work. Whenever they get together into a group, the first thing that they will do is figure out what the ranking is. Like,
who is
number one? Who is number two? Who is number three? The hens all do this as well. Hen number one, hen number two, hen number three.
Whoa.
And so it's a linear thing. If you have multiple roosters on your farm or your residence or in this little group, whatever, and they're all with each other, they have a pecking order, because if you keep them separate from each other, they can't establish a pecking order.
Right,
but if they have a pecking order, the first rooster to crow in the morning will be rooster number one of the pecking order. And then only after him, rooster number two will crow. And then number three, etc. And if somebody crows out of turn, they will go beat him up.
Oh my gosh. That's hardcore. That's so, man. That's just like militant.
It's serious. It's serious. And like looking for information on this, there's all these websites for farmers basically like, how do I solve pecking order problems? Separate them for X amount of time. When you reintroduce them, they'll be like a new person, so they'll sort of work it out again. it's all, if you separate them, they all forget about that hen or that rooster.
Wow.
it doesn't mean the new person is going to be at the bottom. Fight and establish dominance, and they'll figure it out again. Yeah.
Oh,
and so if you're going to keep resetting the pecking order, if you need. So why, anyway, we've gotten off track. Why do roosters crow in the morning? Now, you'd think that it was because, they saw the sun, or they sense a change in the light or something in the environment. But it turns out that there's always been stories of like, it seems like the rooster is anticipating the daybreak, because the rooster crows and then the sun comes up like right after. And it's like, what's going on with this? And This was only solved in 2013, year of the face transplant. Yes.
Wow.
So, the year of the face transplant.
The year of the new
breakthroughs
face.
Breakthroughs
left and right. In 2013, researchers at Nagoya University in Japan, first of all, they did what you have to do to figure this out, is they took a bunch of roosters. They put them all in a constantly dark environment. Okay. Total just darkness all the time. Not pitch blackness, but just like no sunlight, no day-night cycle, basically, right? Those roosters still crowed right before dawn.
Incredible.
No way.
Yep.
In the sensory deprivation chamber,
they crowed right before dawn. So they figured out that roosters have a pretty tight internal clock.
Yeah,
and they measured it to about 23.8 hours.
Wow.
Every 23.8 hours, they're like, oh, it's dawn, and they will crow.
Wow.
They then tried, just really messing with these roosters, at various times of day, they would shine lights on them. Let's say it was like dinner time, but the roosters have been in the dark this whole time, and now they put light on them, but at night. Well, the roosters, they then did respond to the light stimulus and they crowed. And they were like, oh, okay, so external stimuli do play into it. When they showed them the lights, when it wasn't actually dawn outside, they measured the volume of the crowing and they didn't crow as much or as loudly. Because so they saw the lights and they were like, cock-a-doodle-doo, I guess? Something seems wrong here. But then when they shone light on them at actual daybreak, remember, they're still in the dark environment, they don't know. When they shone light on them at the time that their internal clock was also telling them it's dawn, then they crowed at full intensity. It's the internal clock that takes precedence. Yeah. This all answers the question of physiologically, how do they do it? But it doesn't answer the question of like, why?
Why?
Like, what's the point of crowing at dawn?
Right, right. Yeah, then what?
Nobody really has a definitive answer for this. It's probably just, I mean, they are the boss of their flock. So there's probably just like, hey, it's morning, get up. We got bird stuff to do. Let's get it on. Also, by the way, I'm still the boss, just in case you guys forgot.
Right. It's like calling shotgun on the way to the car as a kid. You want to make sure. Yeah. By the way. Yeah. Just...
I've been saying, I'm talking about the intensity and the loudness, if you will, the volume of a rooster's crows. They're loud. Yeah. If you've ever been, I hope you've never been next to one when it crowed, because then you probably suffered at least some, like, permanent hearing loss. One study measured the crow of a rooster at 130 decibels.
No way.
Just to be clear, we've talked about decibel levels on the show before. 130. That is like standing 50 feet away from a military jet taking off. That's
outrageous.
So this then raises a question. Does anybody want to guess at what the question is that I'm thinking of?
How do they prevent making themselves deaf? How do they protect themselves?
Yeah. You're right there with me once again. Yes.
Yeah.
Why aren't all roosters deaf? When a rooster fully opens his beak, when a rooster goes and opens his mouth, when it does that, his ear canals partially close off.
Oh my God.
Soft tissue completely covers over the rooster's eardrums.
Oh. My God.
It's just when his mouth is open, and it just all works at this in tandem.
He's got a noise canceling head.
He has noise built-in noise canceling headphones for the rooster, so whenever he crows, his ear canal is partially closed and his eardrum is, my understanding, is completely covered. Isn't that incredible?
Wow. That's amazing. That is really something.
I did find out one more thing that I just wanted to throw in there. Do you know, as I was doing all of my research, why there have to be two doors on a chicken coop?
Oh.
Mm. I don't even know what chicken coop looks like. How do they open? Is it like
it's like a little house for the chickens. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like a pet door kind of.
Just
like
right. Okay. Yeah. So why there have to be two doors on a chicken coop? You know why?
Like something with an escape route or something, or
I'll tell you. No, I'll tell you. Because if it had four doors, it would be a chicken sedan.
Oh my!
I hate you.
I can't believe you got me so bad. So bad.
I'm like, I don't know what it looks like.
Mercifully, I am now done.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles. Smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
I have a quick trivia question. This is very, very topical. Just recently in August, who made his live stream debut on Twitch TV as he celebrates turning 70 this year?
Who made his
morning life? Morning related.
Okay. 70.
Disclaimer, I used to work at Twitch, and this is like the kind of cool ad deals that I would be part of the team working on. Who made his live stream debut on Twitch TV as he celebrates turning 70 this year?
70.
He's not a real person.
Oh. Okay. Tony the Tiger.
Oh, that's a good guess.
Tony the Tiger.
Okay.
Tony the Tiger. I think played some Fall Guys. And
oh, really? Oh, God.
It's not like a person in a Tony the Tiger fursuit.
Was it a VTuber?
It was a VTuber. Oh, a VTuber. Gosh. There's a person who is streaming or interacting with a camera, but they're wearing like a motion kind of sensor suit.
Motion capture suit, yeah.
And then the Tony the Tiger or whatever character is mapped on. It's amazing. A quick news story. So the UK government has been trying to pass new laws regarding junk food.
Mm.
They're banning TV advertising before 9 p.m. The government is trying to ban online advertising for junk food.
Wow.
And guess what? This junk food includes sugar cereals. Mm-hmm. And Kellogg's UK, not too happy with that. They actually tried to challenge the government and argued that it was unfair that sugar cereals counted as junk food in the eyes of the UK government because it did not take into account the milk that's usually added to the cereal.
We're part of this complete breakfast, just like it says.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
The judgment dismissed the claim because the addition of milk has no effect on how much sugar.
It doesn't reduce the sugar, yeah.
Well, the sugar comes off of the cereal and it goes into the milk. So shouldn't you be banning the milk once the sugar goes in it?
And then, Colin, you said something about, oh, part of the complete breakfast. I mean, if you're a kid of 80s, 90s, maybe even now with cereal commercials.
Yeah. You're sitting there in the morning, you're eating your cereal, you're watching TV, and it's like Frosted Flakes is part of this complete breakfast. And it's literally just like, you have the bowl of cereal, you got two eggs over easy, you got the toast, you have your glass of milk, then there's a glass of orange juice. And it's just like, and you look at, it's like, Mom, I think you're supposed to be serving me this in the morning. The TV says that this is the complete breakfast. Shut up. Go to school.
Here's a question for you. There are two things that make up a complete breakfast, according to the American Chemical Society.
Okay.
Two things.
Carbon and...
Carbohydrates and protein.
Wow.
They literally, so cereal companies literally can say they are part of a complete breakfast because there's carbs.
There's the carbs in there, right?
Right.
If you just get some eggs in the background, you're like, oh, good. Yeah, we're set. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we just discussed, I am very much not a morning person. Despite having a child, who I do have to get up for, I very much am a coffee person. I think I have coffee every day. What are your guys' go-tos? And Chris, maybe back in the days when you did have coffee. Like, for
I can
me,
tell
it's
you
like,
Chris's order.
Oh, yeah. Go on.
Iced coffee venti with half and half and 6 packets of Splenda.
Yeah, they have to understand, like, these things are big. And I usually get it with, like, minimal ice. Actually, now I can do a lot less Splenda. So if I have, like, if I do have coffee or, like, a decaf or something like that, I only need, like, 2, maybe 3 for that same size. But yes, it's true. I did used to absolutely load it up with artificial
Splenda. You got to know what you like. You have to know what you like. What about you, Karen?
I'm really actually not that picky at all.
Yeah.
I have no discerning palate when it comes to coffee. To me, it's like a treat. Do you know what I mean?
Okay,
like,
I do know what you mean. Like, I'll drink airplane coffee. I don't mind. Like, if it's like, I like hot caffeine, you know? I mean, it's, I've got a wide range of acceptable. Mm-hmm. You probably see where I'm going with this. You're both very smart people here. I have put together for you a coffee-based quiz.
Okay.
Ooh.
Let's do this as a buzz-in. Grab your buzzers here. All right, well, let's start with the coffee bean. The coffee bean. Lovely, lovely coffee bean. It is not actually a bean. What is it? Karen.
It is a berry.
You're close. What is the coffee bean? The
pit.
Yeah, it's a pit. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, okay. I didn't want to make you dance too much for it. But yeah, that's right. It's like a stone fruit, essentially. And so the coffee bean is the seed. It's like the little seed inside the fruit, you know, and they usually come, as you know, probably in two halves, like little, you know, halves of the brain.
Oh.
That's why they're flat on one side.
It's two.
It's two. They come, they almost always come together two like that. And then they pop them open and roast them and then grind them. Occasionally, though, coffee cherries, they do produce a single pod seed where it's not the little half.
Whoa,
and
weird.
Those are called pea berries. If you've ever seen at your high-end coffee shop, sometimes you'll see a pea berry blend. That's what the pea berry is. The pea berry, P-E-A, pea berry. It's about 5% of the coffee crop are single seeds, single pea berries. And they'll separate those out because some people do swear they taste different, better, you know, whatever. And so sometimes you can find pea berry only. I've had pea berry, but I did not at the time realize that's what I was drinking. So the next time I see somewhere that has a pea berry, I'm going to get it and see if I can discern any difference. Yeah.
I mean, as we've just discussed, like, all of this stuff makes no difference to me whatsoever. Somebody's like, ah, yes, a rich Bolivian dark roast. And I'm going to half and half in one hand and like Splenda in the other. And just like, oh, yeah, I can totally taste the richness of the. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hot, right? Yeah. Great. Yeah.
yeah.
Since the late 1950s, the fictional character Juan Valdez has appeared in ads promoting the coffee from what country?
Oh.
Chris.
Colombia.
It is Colombia. Okay. Yeah.
I thought
you were
gonna ask me a brand, but is it not a brand? Is it literally just like
it's one of these sort of like a trade brand, essentially. It was created by the Coffee Growers Association.
Okay.
You know, in conjunction with an American, advertising firm, essentially.
Right,
created to raise awareness of and good feelings toward and sell Colombian coffee into the US originally, primarily. Yeah.
He was right. Juan Valdez, he was right up there with like the time to make the donuts guy. And the,
yeah,
the
there was a
the
time.
Charmin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You don't see the TV ads as much anymore. It's been a while since he was a presence there, but he's part of the logo. And there have been a couple, actors and men over the years who portray Juan Valdez. Yeah. The original Juan Valdez has passed away. Rest in peace. Yeah. The brand kind of, exceeded just being an awareness there. I mean, there are Juan Valdez coffee shops, they've really, it is a coffee name. It's done the job. Colombian coffee definitely has a good rep here.
Yeah. Right.
In the US, certainly. All right. Softball. You should know this. This one comes up in pub quiz all the time. More caffeine in a shot of espresso or an 8-ounce cup of drip coffee?
Oh.
Karen.
50-50, espresso.
I'm sorry. There is more total caffeine in the average 8-ounce cup of drip coffee than there is in the average...
How much more?
Basically, twice,
No
pretty
way!
Much. Yeah, Now, of course, it varies from restaurant to restaurant, but on average, you can expect a 1-ounce shot of espresso have 65 milligrams of caffeine in there, maybe a little bit more. And you can expect an 8-ounce cup of drip coffee to have 100, 120, 150 milligrams of caffeine in there.
I have a personal question that's not going to be personal anymore. Sometimes when I drink too much coffee, I feel like my pee smells like caffeine or coffee. You guys get that?
I have had that experience before too.
Oh yeah, no, I stopped drinking coffee. It didn't have anything to do with the smell of my pee, but it was like, I'm getting really bad stomach aches from like drinking like 5 cups of coffee in a day. I should probably stop doing that.
Espresso has, only been around for, not too much more than 100 years. Espresso's really only been around since like the early 1900s. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. The first espresso machines were, we talk about like the barista pulling an espresso, right? Have you guys heard that term? The first espresso machines were... It was a hand-powered machine. It generated the pressure to drive the steam and through the coffee grounds by hand. And so to kind of crank it and pull the shot. These days, most machines, it generates the pressure for you automatically. You can just, press a button. It is an Italian word, espresso, sort of the home of espresso. In Italian, what does the word espresso mean? Chris.
Is it like speediness or?
Karen.
Pressing.
Yes.
Is it pressing?
The literal derivation of it is
extracting.
It's pressed out. You're pressing it through. Yeah. However, it does certainly, as it's grown around the world, it does also have the additional sort of connotation of express and speedy. Yeah, they both work.
It really
it's a nice kind of double. It's a nice double meaning.
Hey, you guys know coffee? Yeah, I came up with a machine that makes it like a lot harder to make. You've got to like
sounds great.
Pull down on this huge lever.
Steam.
Like, oh, let's try that. Yeah. Right. And it's really dangerous. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. They say when I was reading about the history of espresso that like part of the other appeal of it was the sort of the personal bespoke nature of the cup of coffee. It's here is your individual cup that really contributed to kind of the rise of the popularity of espresso. In 1908, German housewife Melita Benz revolutionized the world of coffee making when she came up with what coffee innovation?
Oh, jeez.
Karen.
Oh, maybe a housewife. I was going to say instant coffee or freeze-dried coffee.
It is not. But yeah, you're on the right track. Something that you could innovate using household ingredients. Melita Bentz.
Household ingredients?
Yeah, or household items, anyway. It's as popular today as it's ever been.
Oh, gosh.
Melita Bentz invented... pour over paper filter coffee.
Oh, right. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, 1908. And in fact, the Melita is one of the leading names in coffee filters. You go to the store, the red green label. I promise you have seen them in the store.
Oh,
Melita
yeah.
coffee cone filters. Keep in mind, it seems crazy to say it now, but like up to this time, the traditional way of making coffee was you ground up your coffee, you put it in with some hot water. You kind of stirred it up and cooked it, and you carefully poured out the stuff off the top. And you did your best not to get the grounds in, and that was how you made coffee. And she got tired of grounds in her coffee, and she said, there's got to be a better way. She took a brass pot. She punched holes in the bottom.
Oh.
She took a sheet of blotter paper from her son's school supplies, and she lined the bottom of the pot, and she put it on top of the coffee pot, put the grounds in, poured her boiling water over, and voila, it filtered out all the grounds, nice, clean cup of coffee. And she patented the idea, and she launched the business that, as I say, still bears her name to this day. It may not surprise you to learn that the USA is the largest importer of coffee by volume. We have a lot of people, we drink a lot of coffee. The USA, we import the most raw. Give us those beans. That's right. What country produces the most coffee? What country exports by a significant margin?
Okay.
Yeah. Karen.
Brazil.
Ooh. Wow. Correct. You got it. Ooh, that's nice. Right. Good. Call.
Like, it has to be in terms of the amount of land to grow land coffee. Like,
Yeah. As high as 45% of the world production of coffee from Brazil, from what I read. Coffee has long been a staple supply for soldiers in the field. During what war did American soldiers first receive ready-to-mix coffee?
Oh.
All right, so not grinding it up themselves. The first, where the government handed them a product, you just add water. What war?
Okay.
I'm thinking, oh, okay, you go first.
I'm going to say, like, post-space race, I'm going to say Vietnam War.
Interesting. I was going to say Korea War.
Oh, interesting. Could be. Or maybe we're both going the wrong direction entirely, and it's, like, way earlier than we thought it was.
I was surprised, and there's maybe a little qualification, but I was surprised that I phrased it very specifically. The first ready-to-mix, just-add water coffee was provided to soldiers in the Civil War.
No!
Yes.
Not instant.
Yeah, well, how was it made then?
So this was the Union Army, I should stress. Coffee was a huge, huge, huge morale booster out on the battlefield. I mean, the government, the U.S. Army, supplied for a very short period, an experimental product called Essence of Coffee.
Yes.
It was like a coffee concentrate. Okay. It was like a sludge. It was not a powder. It was like a reduction. It was pre-sweetened. It was pre-milked and then just sort of reduced down.
Okay.
And you, as the soldier, they would, you know, you're on your own to get the boiling water and mix it up, but you didn't have to grind the beans. You didn't have to carry the beans. You have to carry a grinder. You have to do any of that. I read that it tasted, frankly, terrible. And I've read that it may have caused no small amount of cramps and diarrhea. So it was an experiment. They did go back to just regular kind of coffee rations. The Southern Army had, you know, a lot of blockades going on. I mean, that's one reason why, like, you know, I think we've talked on the show before, like, chicory became a popular coffee substitute. They couldn't get coffee. They just couldn't get coffee beans, right? By World War One, though, what is fairly properly a modern instant coffee was available. It was a powder.
Wow.
No promises here as to how good it was, but it was recognizable as an instant kind of modern style coffee.
Hmm.
On the other end of coffee technology, it's been practically impossible to escape the Keurig K-Cup machine.
Oh, yeah.
at the office, at home, at the dorm, at the gym, everywhere. And if you're not familiar with the K cup, it's a little cup made out of metal foil cap. You stick it in a machine, you close the machine.
But it's like the idea behind the K cup is it just takes all of the mess out of making coffee. And it transfers all of that mess into the innards of a machine. I don't have to think about where the coffee comes from until such time as this machine becomes completely fixed with whatever gunk and goo and, you know, minerals from the water is all in there. And you have to throw it out and buy another machine.
They were new once upon a time. Let's see if you guys know when they came around. We'll do a little, here we go, a little which came first here, a little Brad Pitt or laser showdown. Which was introduced first, the current K-Cup or the movie Shrek? Which... Karen, right away, what's your guess?
Oh, Shrek is life. Shrek.
The movie Shrek was released in 2001. The K-Cup introduced 1998. All right, last one. We'll stick with inventions and innovations here. Close it out. Alan Adler originally made his name as an inventor with record-breaking flying devices before introducing this coffee device with a cult-like following in 2005. Karen.
Chemex.
Not the Chemex, but you're in the right, you know, sort of ballpark. Yeah, so Alan Adler, inventor, record-breaking flying devices. Maybe a little bit of a clue there.
Yeah, sure.
I am looking for the AeroPress.
That makes sense. AeroPress. God, I had one.
The little plunger presser thing. Yeah, I received one as a present. I was a convert. I don't use it all the time.
Because it's not messy.
Invented by the same man who invented the Aerobee flying disc.
Oh my gosh.
All right, well, good job, guys. Good job. I hope you are wired up and ready to go.
Chris is shaking his head.
I'm not.
Chris does not approve. You gave us chicken coop. Come on.
I know on the top of the show, I shared my story about mimosas. And I was like, oh, it's champagne and orange juice. So breakfast, so healthy. And, you know, on Good Job Brain, we love food trivia. And we love examples of genius advertising.
Yeah. True.
So here for our final segment, I have something called Orange You Glad. Orange You Glad. Why did orange juice and orange become a breakfast food? Why do we associate it with breakfast? You're not like late at night, what a treat, orange juice. In your head, you're like, this is a breakfast drink. This is a, maybe 100%. A breakfast fruit. Yeah.
100%.
Albert Lasker, the ad exec at the agency Lord & Thomas, was tapped to help the California Fruit Growers Exchange. In the 1900s, like 1900, California experienced a huge citrus boom. Growers were producing like an insane amount of oranges, and the demand was pretty low. It didn't really match the supply. What do? You can decrease the amount of oranges you're growing, or you increase the people's demand and want for it. Right. And the latter sounds better because it has the better potential to make more money. Now, California Fruit Growers Exchange doesn't really roll off the tongue very well, right? CFGE, California Fruit Growers Exchange, California Fruit Growers Exchange. So they were advised by their ad agency to maybe use like a different name, a more like a tempting brand name that maybe conveyed, you know, a California flair.
Okay.
So the California Fruit Growers Exchange ended up using the brand name Sun-Kissed.
Yeah.
What a terrific name. It's Sun-Kissed, right? Kissed Perfect. By a sun, but Perfect. It's K-I-S-T. It's kind of a newish word, so you don't have to deal with as many trademark or copyright problems. Right. So to make these sun-kissed oranges stand out, they were actually wrapped. They were wrapped and decorated with wrapper and stamp and stickers. Because you go in, it's like oranges are just like kind of in a tub, right? Mm. Now, these are like sun-kissed oranges. They have their special wrappers. But the shopkeepers, like the merchants, they had a bad habit of just taking off the wrapper and wrap crappier oranges. So this caused a really big problem because it's like, this is diluting the Sunkist brand, right? Yeah. These are crappier oranges. They don't want this to happen. So to solve this problem, Sunkist did such an amazing move. Sunkist ran ads. I'm just going to read the big headlines. This is the 1900s, right? Sometimes they write like novels.
Yes.
For breakfast, try Sunkist oranges, luscious tree-ripened fruit. Please serve Sunkist oranges at breakfast tomorrow and learn the superiority of tree-ripened, seedless, fiberless oranges over the commonplace kind.
Oh, man.
Don't fail to save the wrappers. Save 12 Sunkist wrappers. Send them to us with 12 cents, and we will present you with a genuine Rogers orange spoon of beautiful design and highest quality. Begin saving wrappers today.
Ah, smart.
Oh, consumers, give us back the wrapper. Ask for the Sunkist oranges. Save the wrappers. Mail it back to us, and we'll mail you a spoon.
Smart. Oh, of the highest quality. 100% real metal. And the best part is, I really love the, it's like, this is the Don Draper thing where it's just sort of like, when do you get the oranges? It's like, they get ripe on the tree and then we take them down after they're ripe. Oh, great. They're tree ripened.
Tree ripened.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, we joke about the spoon. The spoon is real metal. They're not like a regular spoon. They're spoons for you to eat oranges with. It's like, you know, what we call a grapefruit spoon.
Wedge
angle. Yeah.
This campaign was so successful. Successful. Yeah. Not only did it make Sunkist the world's largest purchaser of cutlery because they were giving away so many spoons.
Wow. I love stuff like that. Wow. That's great. Yeah.
Importantly, it pushed eating oranges for breakfast. Eating. We're not even at drinking it. We're at eating.
Right.
Okay, let's sell more oranges. Okay, let's juice them.
Yeah.
In 1916, shoppers could buy a pair of oranges bundled with a beautiful glass juice extractor.
Oh, nice.
Do you remember old like orange juice extractors?
Yeah.
It's flat and then it has like a little mountain and you press the orange into it. And the campaign was drink an orange. Eating oranges is too messy. Now you can drink an orange. And this is before orange juice concentrate. I mean, that was a very big win for them too, but decades later. But here's the question. Why breakfast?
Why not like dessert at dinner or something like that? Yeah.
Here's the thing. The California Fruit Growers Exchange also grew another fruit, the lemon. And they can't have two citrus fruits cannibalize or compete with each other for their different PR and marketing strategies or advertising campaigns. So they purposefully positioned orange to be the breakfast fruit. And lemon is the afternoon lemonade, take a break.
Wow.
Both fruits were trying to be sold.
It's so
funny how we think about these things as being, as just sort of having come out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Like the idea of like orange juice for breakfast and lemonade and for a hot afternoon or something like that. And we think it just sort of like just sprung up, you know, sort of naturally, when in fact it was like a deliberate ad campaign, but it was over 100 years ago. So it's like a folk tale. You know what I mean? It's like a modern day folk tale. It's like, but it still affects our lives today.
You made us close our eyes earlier, but if you guys close your eyes now and picture the quintessential Western breakfast, what do you see?
The pancakes, cereal, eggs, orange juice, toast, maybe some bacon or sausage, right?
Most of those things are part of what was pushed to us in the last 100 years. And you just forget about it. I mean, kind of generations pass.
Prior to coffee and tea becoming really widespread, you know what most people would drink as a morning beverage?
Beer.
Yeah, beer. Oh, sure. Just beer. That was, you'd have some beer in the morning and, no one would think twice about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about coffee, about roosters' ears. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on all podcast apps. And on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Movie Therapy, Big Picture Science, and the Secret History of Hollywood. And we'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye. Go, 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 go.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.